their spring growth dulled by dust, past the house, to a long horse stable that had been converted into a garage with 5 double-wide doors. As I approached the stable, one of the electrically powered doors rose, and as I slowed almost to a stop, a man stepped out of the shadowy interior into sunlight. Tall, lean, weathered, wearing boots and jeans and a checkered shirt and a cowboy hat, he would have fit right into any Western that John Ford ever directed. He waved me into the garage, and I parked the big dog where he indicated. As I took off my helmet and goggles, the cowboy introduced himself. He appeared to be as trim and fit as a man in his 40s, but a life outdoors had given him an older face, seamed and as tanned as saddle leather. "Name's Deacon Bullock. Born and raised a Texan, lately of Pico Mundo. It's a 5-star honor to meet you." "I'm just a fry cook, sir." I put the helmet and goggles on the seat of the bike. I shook his hand. "There's no great honor in it." Every one of the many lines in his face conspired to be part of his smile.
"I know your selfsame history, son. Don't be hiding your light under a bushel."
"I don't need a bushel," I assured him. "A paper cup will do."
"You wasn't followed?"
"No, sir."
"You betting ear on that?"
"I'd bet them both."
"This here's a safe house where our folks can hide out, and we mean to keep it safe. You been given a phone we tinkered with?"
I produced my jacket from one of the saddlebags, took the smartphone from the jacket, and handed it to him. When Mr. Bullock activated the phone, the first thing that appeared on the screen wasn't the name of a service provider or phone manufacturer, but instead a single thick exclamation mark in gold against a black background. It remained there until he entered a 5-number code, and then the exclamation point was replaced by a photograph of my smiling face. He nodded, satisfied. After switching the phone off, he returned it to me.
"You understand, son, it don't transmit your location when you use it, like all them other dang phones do, and it don't identify the owner. Any call you got to make, or text message you got to send, or any web surfing you got to do while you're on this here property, or off it for that matter, you use only this one phone."
"It's the only one I have, sir. Mrs. Fisher gave it to me."
"The head honcho herself. All right, then. I'm told you travel light as a mayfly, but you must have yourself some luggage."
"Yes, sir." From the compartment in which I'd stowed the jacket, I retrieved a zippered leather kit that contained my electric razor and toiletries, and from the other saddlebag on the big dog, I took a matching soft-sided overnight bag that contained a pair of jeans, a couple of t-shirts, spare underwear, socks. Somehow they learned what I'd be riding. We had a little confrontation a few hours back. The bike is hot.
"So then we'll shred her and melt her down."
When I realized he was serious, I said, "Isn't that a little extreme?"
"Not when you're dealing with them folks."
I looked at the beautiful big dog. Sad.
"Let me help with that," Mr. Bullock said, and took the bag from me. "Nothing I hate worse than being useless."
As I closed the lid of the saddlebag, he said,
"So I'm given to understand you don't have yourself a suitable gun."
"Neither suitable nor unsuitable, sir." His eyes were blue, and when he narrowed them, they seemed to grow brighter, as if his squint compressed the color in them.
"How come you rode through all that dangerous habitat of scheming men and all that wasteland crawling with snakes and beasts, and you with no dang gun?"
"I don't like guns, Mr. Bullock."
"You don't need to like one to know you got to have it. I don't like getting a colonoscopy every 5 years, but I grit my teeth and drop my drawers and get it done just the same."
"I've never had a colonoscopy either."
"Well, you're not of an age to need one. That there is a joyful experience you got to earn by living to my age. Anyways, around this here safe house, everyone's got to have themselves a firearm, not just to keep in a drawer, but to carry at all times. Once we get you settled in, I'll fix you up with the very thing you need. You had yourself some breakfast yet?"
"More than some, sir. Just need a bed. I didn't sleep last night."
"Then bring yourself on in the house and meet Maybelle. She's my missus. You'll like her. Everybody does. She's a peach." We haven't enjoyed a bit of company since that astronaut had to hide out here while we worked up a convincing new identity for him. Maybelle starved for better company than me.
13. Maybelle Bullock was a pretty lady of about 50, trim and blonde. She reminded me of that long-ago actress Donna Reed, the way Miss Reed had looked in It's a Wonderful Life. When we entered from the back porch, Maybelle was standing at the kitchen sink, peeling fresh peaches, wearing a house dress of the kind that few women wore in recent years, with saddle shoes and white socks. She didn't at first favor me with a smile, but her handshake was firm and her manner welcoming. Her direct stare probed, as if the story of my life were written in my eyes in a few succinct lines that she could read. To her husband she said, "He's not fully smooth and blue, but he sure is close to it."
"I figured you'd see him that way," said Deacon Bullock.
"Don't you?"
"Well, I'd be a fool to argue it."
In the 7th volume of these memoirs, this is the 8th, I've written about the mysterious organization into which I'd been welcomed by E.D. Fisher, who will appear before much longer in this book as well. Although I'd been told by her and others that I was remarkably smoothed out and blue for someone my age, I'd not been able to get from them an explanation of that apparent compliment. I was a novice among them, and evidently the full truth of who they were and what they hoped to achieve would be revealed to me only in stages, as I earned the right to more knowledge of them. Maybelle's smile, when now it came, was as warm as any I'd ever received, one of those that makes you feel like long-loved kin. She took my hand in both of hers, not to shake it again, but to squeeze it gently. She said, "It's purest pleasure being to help whatsoever way we can."
"Thank you, ma'am. I don't want to be a bother."
"You couldn't be a bother if you tried." Picking up the paring knife once more, she said, "I'm making peach pie to have with your lunch, your favorite."
I didn't ask how she could know the variety of pie that I most enjoyed. She would tell me or she wouldn't. Among these folks, a novice had to live by their rules, even if they chose not to share some of those rules with him.
"Peach pie? That's kind of you, Mrs. Bullock."
"Please, you call me Maybelle."
"Yes, ma'am, thank you. But I'm afraid I'll probably sleep right through lunch, not having slept last night. What I need most now is a bed."
"Then we'll have us a late lunch, early dinner."
Deacon Bullock said, "He don't got a gun."
His wife looked first astonished and then severely disapproving.
"Why would a fine young man such as yourself not carry a gun?"
"I don't like them."
"Guns don't feel nothing about you one way or the other. No fair reason for you to feel bad towards them."
"I guess that's one way to look at it."
She picked up a pistol that had, until now, been lying on the counter on the other side of the basket of peaches.
"Had this Colt since my wedding day."
"Well, how long have you been married, ma'am?"
She cast a loving look at her husband.
"Be 28 years come August 9, and only 6 bad days in all that wedded bliss."
Deacon Bullock's grin went flatline.
"Only 5 bad days by my calculation, sugar."
Picking up the paring knife to slice the peach that she had just peeled, his wife said,
"Even if it was 5 by both counts, won't all of them be the same 5 for each of us?"
Mr. Bullock appeared mildly stricken.
"Well, how many of your 6 do you think don't match my 5?
"I'd guess 2.
"What 2 days did I think we was good and you felt we wasn't? That's going to trouble my sleep till I figure it out."
Mrs. Bullock winked at me but spoke to her husband.
"It'll do you some good to reflect on it."
Taking off his Stetson and fanning his face, her husband said, "Well, guess I got my assignment for the day."
To me, his wife said, "From what I heard, whether you like guns or don't, you've got the skills and guts to use them."
"Unfortunately, it's been necessary."
"So it will be again. What gun was it you most recently used?"
"A Glock with a 15-round magazine."
"What caliber?"
she asked. 45 ACP.
"That be Model 21, Deke?"
"Well, I suspect so," her husband said.
"We got one for this young man?"
"More than one," Mr. Bullock said.
"One will do," I assured them.
"Oddie, Deke will take you up to your room. You sleep like a bear if you can. Don't worry yourself none about when's dinner. When it is, will be when you're ready for us to put it on the table."
Thank you, ma'am. You're very kind.
The mister here has 5 days when he mightn't have agreed with you on that. And you call me Maybelle.
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Bullock led me through rooms where mohair upholstered sofas and armchairs were graced with antimacassars, where mantel clocks and one grandfather clock ticked, where well-tended ferns cascaded from decorative plant stands. On the walls hung framed needlepoint scenes that seemed to have been inspired by Currier and Ives, and between panels of brocade draperies hung lacework shears, so that I felt as though I'd been dropped backward in time 100 years or more. My bedroom offered more of the same, the kind of room where I might have stayed during a visit to my grandmother, if the only grandmother I'd ever known had not been a professional gambler and hard drinker who spent most of her life on the road in search of one illegal high-stakes poker game or another. I loved Pearl Sugars, my mother's mother, but Granny Sugars would have curled up like a pill bug and died rather than have to live a single day in such Victorian orderliness and calm. I, on the other hand, could have stayed contentedly in that room for a month, because it was such a welcome relief from the chaos and violent drama of my life. Not that I would be given that much time. I would probably have to settle for 8 hours. The bed had been turned down. A drinking glass and an insulated carafe of ice water stood on a tray atop the right-hand nightstand, and beside the carafe waited a crystal decanter containing Scotch whiskey. Mr. Bullock informed me that many other libations were available on request. The small ensuite bathroom lacked a tub, but had a shower. A relaxing hot shower might help you to sleep the sleep of the innocent, he suggested.
I believe you're right, sir.
You just go ahead and call me Deke. Every mother's son does.
Thank you, sir.
While you're showering up and brushing your teeth, I'll be back here with your gun, so don't go locking me out. I'll put the little darling in the top drawer of that there nightstand.
Later, when I came out of the steamy bathroom in a robe that had been provided, I opened the nightstand drawer and found the Glock, plus 2 loaded 15-round magazines, in addition to the one that was already in the pistol. The sight of the weapon depressed me. Well, not the sight of it, but the hard fact that I would almost certainly need to use it. Both windows provided a view of the colonnade of velvet ash trees in the driveway, leading to the state route. Here, beyond the city limits of Pico Mundo, there were no sidewalks, no street lamps, only a few hardscrabble farms, an occasional ranchette where people bred one kind of horse or another, mostly quarter horses for racing, lots of dust, and a sky paled by bleaching sun and dry desert air. I drew shut the draperies, locked the door, took off the robe, and slipped under the covers, grateful that the house was well air-conditioned. I left the nightstand drawer open to be sure that I could have the pistol in hand quickly, if I woke and needed it. 14. Some dreams matter. Most don't. Often it can be hard to know which might be which. The dream that afflicted me in the bedroom of the Bullock house was more intensely real than a 3D movie, and if it had needed a movie title, I would have called it The Swimmer. Both during the unfolding of the dream and after I woke from it, I had no doubt that it mattered. I swam underwater without effort, hardly kicking my feet, never stroking with my arms, as if drawn along by a current. And either I had no need to breathe, or I breathed in water and took oxygen from it as efficiently as a fish. I drifted through the flooded central historic district of Pico Mundo, which was genuinely quaint in some places and artificially quaint in others, the latter buildings having been added after downtown had become a tourist destination because it was so picturesque. Numerous specialty shops and restaurants and bakeries and art galleries lined these streets. Light from their windows and from the antique cast-iron street lamps, each crowned with 3 frosted globes, radiated through the water. The jacaranda trees that lined these avenues were laden with purple flowers that stirred in the water as they might in a mild breeze. Initially, the mood was magical, full of wonder. so that I glided along in a kind of ecstasy, as I had during dreams of flying when I was a boy. Soon, however, the mood changed. I came to feel that this was not a pleasant fantasy of life underwater, that Pico Mundo would not reveal to me a population of mermaids and mermen, that instead it was drowned. Drowned and dead and lost forever. The quality of the light changed subtly at first, the warm and welcoming glow of shop windows turning cold and off-putting. Beyond those display windows, dark shapes now floated, no doubt ruined merchandise adrift in flooded rooms. I did not yet feel suffocated, continued to breathe water for air, but felt the urgent need to know how deeply submerged the town might be, whether under lake or ocean. I worked my arms, fluttered my feet, seeking the surface, but I could not ascend, only continued to drift forward through the streets. The longer I struggled to rise but failed to gain a fraction of a fathom, the more fearful I became, until upon me settled the conviction that this submerged world was a graveyard, the home of death himself, and that life existed only at the surface, which I must reach in order to survive. The light grew not merely cold and uninviting, but also eerie, as if the shops were not shops after all, as if they were the dwellings of sorcerers and necromancers and voodooists, as though beyond their windows much witchery and diabolism were underway. In my peripheral vision, I became aware of something floating beside me, and when I looked more directly, I met the fixed stare of a corpse. A young woman, perhaps 20, floated past, arms limp and moved only by the feeble currents, head turned toward me. She might have been lovely in life, with raven hair and celadon eyes, but she was not lovely now. Her bloodshot eyes bulged in their sockets, and her face was clenched in an expression of stark terror, as though, in the last instant of her life, such a frenzied state of fear had overcome her that even death could not relax her features. When she sailed past me, the current somehow conveying her at greater speed than they moved me, I sensed a looming horror more blood-freezing than a corpse. I eeled about and discovered behind me a flotilla of dead bodies, men and women and children, hundreds and perhaps thousands of them drifting through the weirdly lit flood, none of them bloated with gas and rising toward the surface as a corpse would in the waking world. As they came past me, to both sides and above and below, I saw that in every case the eyes were protuberant, the face frozen, open-mouthed in an expression of extreme fright. A little girl of about 7, her long blonde hair billowing around her like the seeking tentacles of a sea anemone, bumped against me, and I shuddered in revulsion. Her protruding eyes rolled with sudden life, and from her open mouth issued a froth of gas bubbles that broke against my lips and carried with them one word, Contumax. I thrust up from the bed, flailing at the sheets as if I were a drowning man desperately trying to throw off the arms of the sea that would drag him down. I needed a moment to understand that I'd been dreaming, that I'd come awake, and another moment to remember where I'd gone to bed. Although I occasionally indulged in a beer or a glass of red wine, I wasn't much of a drinker. I had no taste for hard liquor. Nevertheless, I fished a few cubes of ice from the insulated carafe, dropped them into the glass, and poured more scotch than I needed. At one of the windows, I drew open the draperies with the pull cord and pushed aside the lace shears. Drinking the scotch, I stood looking out at the colonnades of velvet ash, the dry land, the distant purple mountains. With its fire, the whiskey gradually warmed away the chill with which the dream had left me. A couple of months earlier, in Nevada, I'd rescued children who'd been kidnapped to be used as human sacrifices. The Satanists who abducted them, who now planned some torment for Pico Mundo, were fond of elaborate ceremonies, rituals, secret passwords. They had a formalized greeting, the equivalent of Heil Hitler, which consisted of the first cultist declaring Contumax, Latin for defiant or disobedient, to which the second cultist replied, Potestas, Latin for power. They were declaring that their power came from defying all that was good. What did it mean? The whole town under deep water. Malosuerte Lake, a mecca for boating enthusiasts from all over the southwest, covered a few thousand acres. Not far offshore, it quickly grew deep. The lake lay upland from Pico Mundo, and the town had been built in a shallow bowl in the parched terrain. I didn't know the average depth of Malosuerte, or its exact acreage, or how to calculate the volume of water held back by the breast of the dam. But I couldn't believe a sudden failure of that structure would result in all of Pico Mundo submerged like some modern-day Atlantis. Nearly 40,000 people lived in our town, which was a place of many neighborhoods, from rich to poor, where humanity in its infinite variety dwelt in expectation of no greater catastrophe than perhaps a major earthquake. We anticipated a temblor that one day would cast off the cornices and crack the walls of some of the oldest structures that hadn't been reinforced to meet new building codes. Flash floods happened, sure. But they were nuisances quickly flushed away through both the municipal storm drains and the network of natural arroyos that cut through town and that were bridged by our streets. I didn't realize that I'd finished all of the scotch in my glass until I tasted only ice melt. When, as an aspect of my sixth sense, I had a dream that struck me as predictive, its meaning was sometimes clear, sometimes more difficult to interpret. For that reason, among others, my paranormal abilities seemed to be both a gift and a curse. A flood caused by the purposeful destruction of the dam would cause serious destruction, and dozens, perhaps scores, might die. But I couldn't conceive of any circumstance in which the drowning deaths could mount into the hundreds and thousands. Consequently, perhaps the nightmare had been in part symbolic, its full meaning accessible only after some analysis. A flood, yes, but something else too, a second and simultaneous catastrophic event that multiplied the effect of a dam failure. Such as? Such as. More scotch would not inspire an answer. I needed more time to think. And a better brain with which to do the thinking. 15. When I ventured downstairs a few minutes before 5 o'clock, the knotty pine table in the kitchen had been set for dinner. Mrs. Bullock was pouring iced tea into 3 tall glasses as I arrived, as though she must be psychic herself and therefore anticipated the precise moment of my appearance.
"You look all the way rested, fresh and ready for anything short of Judgment Day," she declared. "But where's the gun my Deke give you?"
"I didn't think I needed to bring it to dinner, ma'am."
"Young man, you need to bring it everywhere your feet take you. Mrs. Fisher says you're a fella's got more common sense than any 100 folks picked random from the phone book."
Edie Fisher, who had taken me as her protege and had assisted me in the rescue of the kidnapped children in Nevada, seemed to be the primary benefactor, if not also the leader of the clandestine organization that maintained this safe house, and, apparently, a vast network of committed followers in secret facilities. She was 86 years old, with the physique of a bird, sometimes enigmatic to the point of being incomprehensible, but she was wealthy enough and wise enough and courageous enough to have earned my respect.
"Unless you mean to make a fool and liar of Edie, the sweetest woman this side of forever," said Mrs. Bullock, "then you best hie yourself up to your room and quick fetch that pistol."
"Yes, ma'am."
As I turned to leave, she said, "And not just the gun, but them spare magazines come with it."
"Be right back," I assured her. 2 minutes later, when I returned with the Glock and the extra magazines, the back door opened and Mr. Bullock stepped into the kitchen, carrying a shotgun. He saw my weapon and smiled broadly.
"Good to see you put your silly don't like 'em behind you and come down packing the way you should."
His wife said,
"He come down defenseless as a fawn, so I sent him up to get himself right."
Mr. Bullock's smile faded to a look of disappointment.
"This here's a war we're in, young fella, even if it's so secret most folks don't never have a clue about it."
"Yes, sir, I know. I'm sorry. I won't forget the rules again. Where should I put it?"
Mrs. Bullock indicated the pistols beside the two plates on the table.
"Quick to hand is best."
As I put the Glock and spare magazines beside the third plate, I said, "Well, something sure smells good." And she said,
"My grandma's best ever meatloaf in cilantro tomato gravy, with just a touch of inspired fiddling by yours truly, plus all the trimmings."
To her husband, she said,
"Seeing as you're alive, must have been a false alarm, like you thought."
"Dang coyote," he said,
as he went to a broom closet tucked into a corner of the kitchen cabinetry.
"Slinking around, maybe hoping for one of the chickens we don't even raise. Set off a motion detector."
Indicating the sunlight at the windows, she said,
"Early for one of their kind, being on the hunt."
Instead of brooms, the broom closet contained a gun rack with another shotgun. Mr. Bullock racked his 12-gauge beside the first weapon and hung his hat on a peg in there.
"It was a bonier specimen than usual. Maybe too hungry to wait out the sun."
He washed his hands as his wife served dinner family style. The meatloaf on a platter, half of it sliced. Butter-rich mashed potatoes mounded in a bowl. Different vegetables in each of four other serving dishes. Two gravy boats to ensure no waiting. A basket of pull-apart rolls. When we were seated, Mr. Bullock said a brief grace, and Mrs. Bullock said, "Amen." And we ate like longshoremen who just worked grueling overtime on the docks. Everything was delicious. Watching me eat, Mr. Bullock said,
"Maybell, this here young fella seems to think your cooking's more out of this world than our astronaut did."
"Everything's delicious, ma'am. It's perfect."
"High praise coming from such a renowned fry cook. I'm flattered."
I said, "Why did the astronaut need a new identity?" They glanced at each other, and she raised her eyebrows, and he shrugged, and she said,
"Edie adores him, Deke. She don't mistake a demon for a saint. And you know what he done, back then, the mall."
To me, Deke Bullock said,
"The astronaut fella seen something up there he couldn't for the life of him keep shut up about."
"Up there?" I asked. Mrs. Bullock pointed at the ceiling.
"Space."
Her husband said, "He was up there doing science or something on the space station a while. The thing happened, and the astronaut was told he never seen what he knew dang well he'd seen."
Mrs. Bullock said,
"So when he gets back, he goes and tells some people he thinks they should know the truth, but they're the wrong ones to tell. Next thing, they're all chasing him."
"Who?"
"CIA,
Mr. Bullock said.
Mrs. Bullock said, "FBI, too."
"IRS,
Mr. Bullock added.
"Occupational Safety and Health Administration."
"Social Security Administration."
"Library of Congress, and heaven only knows who else,"
Mrs. Bullock said. I considered all of that for a moment, and then I asked, "How did he find his way to you?"
"Never did," Mr. Bullock said. "Edie Fisher found him, how she finds so many. She took him someplace for a new face, then brung him here so he could paper him up with a new name."
I took a second slice of meatloaf. "What did he see up there?" Neither of them replied. "I mean up there in space," I said. "What did he see up there in space?" Mrs. Bullock had gone pale.
"Better we don't say."
"Not a bit of good can come of saying," her husband agreed.
"It's not that we don't trust you, Addie,"
she assured me.
Mr. Bullock looked grim. "It's just you don't never want it in your head. I mean the thing that happened up there."
"Once it's in your head, there's no getting it out, what the astronaut described."
Mrs. Bullock shuddered.
"Them images,"
she said, in a tone of voice in which she might have said, "Oh, the horror."
"Them images,"
Mr. Bullock agreed, having gone whiter than the mashed potatoes. Mrs. Bullock said,
"Them images keep coming back on you when you least expect.
and your blood runs ice cold.
Ice cold, her husband agreed and nodded solemnly.
The woman nodded solemnly, too.
The three of us sat there, nodding, until Mr. Bullock suddenly turned his head to look at the window above the sink, as if he'd heard something that unsettled him. Maybelle's right hand went to the pistol beside her plate, and she turned in her chair to look at the same window.
Deke?
Probably nothing, he said.
I was facing the window that interested them. I didn't see anything alarming. I didn't hear anything either. After they'd been staring at the window for the better part of a minute, Mr. Bullock said,
I'm just jumpy.
You sure?
Maybelle asked.
As sure as a fella can ever be in a world where every dang place you set foot, there's a trap door waiting to be sprung.
He returned to his dinner, but he ate with his left hand so that he could keep the right one on his pistol. After we finished the meal in silence, Maybelle looked at me and broke into a smile as radiant as the one Donna Reed turned on Jimmy Stewart in the last scene of It's a Wonderful Life.
Oddie, time for your favorite peach pie.
Mrs. Bullock seemed to be of good cheer again, but her husband regarded the window with a frown, as though he doubted that we would live long enough to enjoy dessert.
16.
Mr. Bullock provided me with a shoulder holster that held both the Glock and the spare magazines. In front of a freestanding full-length mirror in my room, I shrugged into the rig and adjusted it while he stood watching and nodding approvingly. He owned two sport coats, two more than I did, a black one for funerals, and a powder blue one for what he referred to as warm weather dress-up occasions. He'd worn the latter only once when, in 110-degree desert heat, a friend had held a memorial service for a beloved house cat. Although the blue number went with my white t-shirt, jeans, and white sneakers, the pastel shade of it made me feel a little bit like a dandy.
Nothing matters, he said, but what if fits you loose enough to hide that there gun you're packing? You got yourself the phone?
Yes, sir.
The little flashlight I give you?
It's on the dresser.
Supposing you end up in some hugger-mugger where you got to have yourself a pencil light about as bad as an innocent man in the electric chair wants a last-minute go-free call from the governor, but it's not in your pocket, 'cause it's there on the dresser.
He retrieved the little flashlight and handed it to me, and I tucked it into an inside coat pocket. He asked if I had enough money, and I assured him that I did, and he told me to be careful, and I said that I would. He tugged on the lapels of the sport coat and smoothed the shoulders, and I felt as if I were being sent off on my first date. In the kitchen, Mrs. Bullock insisted on hugging me and kissing me on the cheek before I left, a rather different send-off from any that James Bond ever got from his handlers at MI6. Outside, in the last hours of light, Deke Bullock used a remote control to open one of the garage doors on the converted stable. I had said that I wanted an inconspicuous set of wheels. Of the two vehicles in the stall, he gave me the keys to a 15-year-old Ford Explorer that was dinged, scraped, and in need of being washed.
She looks like a worn-out old spavined mare, don't she? But under the hood, she's a spirited filly.
I'm just going to ride around town, see what there is to see, feel it out. I don't expect I'll have to outrun a hot pursuit. He nodded and patted me on one shoulder.
Well, let's hope it don't come to that. But just when a man expects he's earned a little bit of milk and honey, the world throws a load of horseshit at him.
I'll keep that in mind, sir.
Now, say you find yourself coming back here after midnight. Then you call the number I give you earlier, so I can get out of bed and open the door for you instead of shooting you dead. Tell me you got the number memorized?
Yes, sir, but I don't want to disturb you folks.
You couldn't if you tried, son. The missus don't sleep at all anymore, and I don't need but an hour a night.
Because you're fully smoothed out and blue? I asked. When I'd first met Edie Fisher, she had claimed she never slept anymore. In time, I'd learned that she was telling the truth, although I still didn't understand why she didn't need sleep, or what she meant by fully smooth and blue. She promised that understanding would come to me in time.
When you're given a life as bizarre as mine, you tend to be accepting of other people's strangeness and eccentricities.
Maybelle, he said, she's smooth and blue all through, but I got me a ways to go yet. Now, you be careful out there, son. Don't be expecting milk and honey, and maybe then you'll get yourself some.
He watched me drive out of the converted stable and through the tunnel formed by the velvet ashes. As I turned right on the state highway and headed into Pico Mundo, I felt not merely that I was coming home after a long time away, but also felt, stronger than ever, that I had a rendezvous with destiny somewhere in those streets, the destiny that had been promised to me by a carnival fortune-telling machine called Gypsy Mummy. To the east, the sky had turned from blue to bishop's purple, with the gloss of satin. Like a juggled orange coming slowly down, the westering sun swelled as it settled toward the horizon, soon to be a blood orange. West of the historic district, the first neighborhood I cruised was Jack Flats, which 50 years earlier had been called Jack Rabbit Flats. The area had undergone decline when, during city government's crusade to greatly ramp up the quaintness of the downtown streets, non-quaint enterprises like muffler shops and tire stores and pawn shops were forced to relocate to Jack Flats. More recently, the area had begun to undergo gentrification. I can't say what vibe I was searching for, but I didn't feel it in Jack Flats. I drove out of there as the swollen sun balanced on the horizon, pouring red light through the town. Stucco walls glowed carnelian, and every window glimmered like a jewel. Shadows lay long and black. Silhouetted trees were as dark as masses of rising smoke, and the windshields of the passing traffic reflected a fiercely fiery sky, as though every driver must be on a journey to Armageddon. If one kind of hell or another would soon come to this town, there should have been at least a bodock or two slinking along the streets, unseen by all but me, seeking out those soon to be dead, to savor the smell of them as they ripen toward their fate, to thrill at the imminence of their death by stroking them with hands and licking them with tongues that they could never feel. But not one of those featureless, shadowy connoisseurs of violence was in evidence. Without consciously making my way to Marigold Lane, I found myself on that familiar street, in a neighborhood where Victorian houses seemed to have been transported, entire blocks at a time, out of the eastern cities from which many of Pico Mundo's oldest families had migrated during the early decades of the 20th century. In the still red but fading light, I pulled to the curb in front of the house owned by Rosalia Sanchez. A few years earlier, when I lived in the small studio apartment above her detached garage, she had been my landlady and my friend. She would be 65 now, with that saintly face worn by so much caring for others, by loss and grief, by waiting patiently for what she would never receive in this life. Back in 2001, she'd awakened one day to the discovery that her much-loved husband, Herman, had died beside her in his sleep and lay there cold and pale, one eye closed and the other open, staring. Later that same year, still in mourning, she had bowed out of a long-planned vacation to New England that she and Herman had intended to take with her three sisters and their families. On the morning of September 11, Rosalia woke to the news that their return flight out of Boston had been hijacked and flown into one of the World Trade Center towers. Having lost every relative in one year while she was sleeping, without a child of her own to whom she could turn for solace, Rosalia went a little mad. Intellectually, she knew that they were all dead, but in this case, emotion trumped reason. She would never speak of terrorists or plane crashes, nor would she listen to such talk. She chose to believe, instead, that as a consequence of some rare natural phenomenon, everyone she loved had turned invisible. She held fast as well to the theory that soon this event, like a magnetic field, would be reversed, rendering her loved ones visible again. Her madness involved no resentment or anger, and she posed no danger either to herself or to others. She continued to keep her house immaculate, to bake her marvelous cakes and cookies as gifts for friends and neighbors, to attend her church, and to be a force for good in her community, and to wait for her family to be returned to visibility. I never knew whether I was drawn to eccentric people, or if they were drawn to me. Either way, my life had been full of them, and they had enriched it. I suspected eccentricity was often, if not always, a response to pain, a defense mechanism against anguish and torment and sorrow. With a father who played no positive role in my life, and with a mother whose behavior often made her a candidate for an asylum, I'm sure that I would have been the eccentric I became, even if I'd never been gifted or cursed with my sixth sense. No Bodocks were in view along Marigold Lane. As the last light bled out of the day, less than fully aware of how I'd gotten there, I found myself parked across the street from St. Bartholomew's Church, where Stormy's uncle, Sean Llewellyn, still served as the priest and rector. Some of the happiest times that she and I shared were on the open deck of St. Bart's Bell Tower, to which we would sometimes climb with a picnic dinner, to dine there among the immense but silenced bells, surrounded by the best view in Pico Mundo. We felt that we were above all strife in that high redoubt, our future together no less enduring than the town we overlooked. With the approach of night, the tower was uplit, and a red aircraft warn-off light served as a finial at the peak of the belfry roof. As I watched it winking, I recalled how spectacular the sunset had been the last time that Stormy and I had climbed up there with a picnic hamper, on what we could not know would be the final night of her life. No Bodocks crept the front stairs of the church, or climbed the walls, or danced in glee upon the bell tower roof. 4 minutes till 7 o'clock, I pulled back into traffic. Stormy had lived in one of four apartments in a house 3 blocks from the Pico Mundo Grill. In my not-so-random drive through town, I next parked across the street from that place. Orphaned young, supporting herself as a counter girl and then as the manager of an ice cream shop, she had been poor by almost any definition. She'd furnished her humble rooms with items from thrift shops, and yet her apartment had been stylish and comfortable. Old silk-shaded floor lamps with beaded fringes, upholstered Victorian footstools paired with crude imitations of Stickley-style chairs, Maxfield Parrish prints, carnival glass vases, cheap bronze castings of various breeds of dogs displayed on end tables and windowsills. The eclectic mix shouldn't have worked, but it did, because she had magic in her, and because she could see the magic in everyday things. I'd moved out of my studio apartment above the garage and into Stormy's place after she died. I lived there for a year until I left town on my journey of discovery. Her things had been packed away and stored in a room at Ozzie Boone's house. I could dispose of nothing. Every item she owned, however inexpensive it might be, was to me a treasure, a store of memory and a memento of love unrivaled and undying. How long I sat there, across the street from the house in which she had lived, I couldn't be sure. I drove away only when my tremors stopped. Only when the world gradually regained its detail and ceased to be just a blur. Now that night had fully claimed Pico Mundo, I allowed intuition to guide me and cruised to the town square, at the center of which lay Memorial Park with its handsome bronze statue of 3 soldiers from World War II. Unlike the other streets of the historic district, those 4 blocks surrounding the park were lined not with flowering jacarandas, but with magnificent old phoenix palms with enormous crowns of fronds. Couples occupied the park benches, cuddling in the light of the 3-globe cast-iron lampposts. The many restaurants were open, of course, but also all of the specialty shops, which catered as much to tourists as to locals. People were window shopping, some of them carrying cones of ice cream as they ambled from shop to shop, some sipping from Starbucks cups, some walking their dogs, some talking and laughing. Although my perception might have been distorted by melancholy, it seemed to me that most of those people were in pairs, the larger percentage of them holding hands, as if they were extras in a movie of high romance, accessorizing a scene for which the director's purpose might have been to say that life was a parade lived two by two, as it had been since before Noah's fabled ark, and as it would be always. No bodocks capered among the crowd. None slithered under the benches on which couples shared moments of affection. Neither circling the town square nor cruising any of the other streets before this had I received the slightest psychic impression that one day the town would be submerged, a community of drowned and drifting cadavers. Indeed, if Pico Mundo were inundated because of the collapse of Malo Suerte Dam, the town would not stand underwater in precisely the same condition as now, which is how it had appeared in the dream. The rushing water would do great damage, tumbling cars along the streets, uprooting trees, ripping down awnings, smashing windows. No rational scenario allowed for the lights to remain aglow in the aftermath of such a disaster, as they had been when I floated through my nightmare. Brooding about that, I circled Memorial Park a second time and saw an enormous banner that I had somehow overlooked before. It was strung across an intersection, big red and black letters on a white background announcing the annual spring fair at the Maravilla County Fairgrounds, currently underway. Fun for the whole family. The lowest of the three lines on the banner declared, featuring the world-famous Sombra Brothers Midway Shows. The carnival was back in town. Sombra Brothers Midway Shows had occupied the fairgrounds 6 years earlier, when Stormy and I found the fortune-telling machine in an arcade tent. You might think it was a coincidence that I should return to Pico Mundo in expectation of the fulfillment of the fortune-teller's prediction, just when the Sombra Brothers returned as well. So very much about our strange and deeply layered world remained mysterious to me, but my experiences had taught me, among other things, that there were no coincidences. 17. At ticket booth number 4, the cashier was a plump woman with long ringlets of auburn hair. The carnival had a jackpot drawing to entice people to stay later and spend more. When she took my money and gave me an admissions ticket, she said, "Honey, be sure you stay for the big drawing at 11:45. 3 nights the winners didn't hang around to collect, so now it's up to $22,000. Got to be here to win. Hang on to your ticket. You're the one tonight, honey." She had such a beatific smile that her sales pitch seemed like a sincere prediction. My intuition, which is seldom wrong, insisted the carnival held secrets that, if revealed, would help me to discover the meaning of my nightmare and the nature of the threat hanging over Pico Mundo. Carnies are a tightly knit community and generally more law-abiding than the rest of us, but there was no reason to dismiss the notion that a few cultists might have made their home in the Sombra Brothers operation, perhaps without other carnies being aware of their demonic nature and their keen interest in terrorism. The first thing I did after paying admission and entering the fairground was to head for the southern perimeter of the Midway, where in the past there had been a long row of specialty tents, including games, not of the arcade kind, and novelty services. The offerings along that flank of the concourse were pretty much as they had been in years past, among them Bingo Palace, Quarter Toss, an air rifle shooting gallery, wearable art, where an artist with an airbrush would paint any image you wanted on a t-shirt. Face It, where you could have your face decorated with water-soluble paints in an almost infinite variety of ways. Although I had not intended to go anywhere incognito, I changed my mind about that when it came to the carnival. If possible, I preferred to prowl the Midway without being recognized. I'd not lived in Pico Mundo for the past 11 months, but I had known a lot of people there. Furthermore, after the events at Green Moon Mall almost 2 years earlier, photos of me had been in the newspapers. Therefore, I might be recognized by many people whom I didn't know. Some of them would tell me that I was a hero, which would be embarrassing. I'd never felt like any kind of hero, considering that, even with my intervention, 19 people had died that day. Almost as disturbing, some of those who recognized me might be the cultists who currently wanted to kill me. The front of the face-it tent was entirely open. On the interior hung blown-up photos of previous customers whose faces had served as canvases for the artists who owned this little concession. I wondered what their true faces had looked like before they'd been painted. Of course, a fresh scrubbed face may be a lie, and the truth may be a darkness behind it. An attractive dark-haired woman in her early 40s sat on a chair beside a table on which were arranged different brushes, as well as bottles of paint and Ziploc bags of glitter in a wide variety of colors. She applied a brush and a small sponge to the face of a teenage girl who sat before her on another chair, working upward from the chin, already at the forehead, creating a floral scene, so that the girl appeared to be peering out at the world through a bouquet of wildflowers. Or perhaps she was meant to be a meadow nymph, with a face composed of flowers. A second teen, friend of the seated girl, stood watch, already given a leopard's visage, her face a rich golden orange with black spots and realistically rendered cat whiskers. A second artist also worked in the tent. Currently not engaged, she smiled and raised her eyebrows quizzically and with a gesture invited me to the chair in front of her. Judging by appearance, this painter could be the daughter of the other. Attractive, with black hair and celadon eyes, she was unmistakably the dead woman from my dream, the first corpse that had drifted past me through the drowned streets of Pico Mundo. When I sat in the chair, she said, "How do you want to look?" "Different," I said, "very different." She considered me in silence for a moment, and then said, "I can do all the faces you see on the walls here, and almost anything else. Any character or animal, or something abstract." "Surprise me," I said. She smiled again. "No one's ever asked to be surprised before. Nobody wants to risk looking foolish." "Why would you make me look foolish?" "Oh, I wouldn't. Why would I? But most people want to look cool, and there's a thin line between cool and foolish." I liked her voice. It had a smoky quality. She'd not spoken in the dream. The corpse of the little girl, born along after her, was the one that said, "Contumax." "What's your name?" I asked, as she studied her bottles of paint and evidently considered what design she intended to create.
"Connie, what's yours?"
"Norman," I replied, and wondered if we both had lied. "How long have you worked in the carnival?"
"I grew up in it. What do you do, Norman?"
"I'm a librarian." She met my eyes.
"You don't look like a librarian."
"What do I look like?"
"You look like an Ethan, not a Norman. And you look like maybe a Navy SEAL or an Army Ranger, not a librarian."
"Not really. I'm no tough guy."
"Truly tough guys never say they're tough."
"Some of them do, and then they beat on you to prove it." Opening a bottle of paint, she said,
"You don't look beaten up."
"I avoid confrontation."
"By taking the other guy down before he lands a blow?"
"Well, I prefer to run like hell away from him." Picking up a brush, she said,
"Please close your eyes and keep them closed. I don't want to get pain in them."
I closed my eyes and asked, "Why Ethan?"
"I have an older brother named Ethan. The name is from the Hebrew, meaning permanent, assured."
"Does he paint faces, too?"
"He was supposed to run the bingo palace that my dad owns, but he wanted to do something else. If the brush tickles, tell me, and I'll use a sponge instead, as much as I can."
"It doesn't tickle. What does your brother do?"
"He's a Navy SEAL."
I wanted to open my eyes to study hers, but I didn't.
"So I must look a little like your brother."
"You don't look anything like him, but you have an Ethan quality about you."
"Is that a good thing?"
"It's the best thing."
"You're embarrassing me here."
"That's something Ethan would say."
She worked quickly, and in 10 minutes or so, she told me that I could look, whereupon she gave me a large hand mirror. Around my eyes, she'd painted a harlequin's mask. Otherwise, from hairline to jawline, she'd drawn a pattern of black and white diamonds, so perfectly straight-edged, in spite of the contours of my face, that it had the effect of making my features all but disappear into that rigid geometry. Even Stormy would not have recognized me. "A harlequin's a clown," I said.
"More accurately, a buffoon. When I asked how you would like to look, you said, 'Different, very different.' I can't imagine anything more different from what you are than a buffoon."
I met her stare and said, "Have you ever had a dream that came true, Connie?" She didn't immediately reply. She took the mirror from me and put it on the table. She met my stare and held it, and at last said,
"Only once. I don't dream all that much."
"Was it a dream about a flood? A whole town drowned in it?" She glanced at her mother, who had finished with a second teenager and was working on a 10-year-old girl while the child's parents watched with delight. None of them were paying attention to us, but Connie lowered her voice anyway.
"No, not a flood. It was a dream about this guy who walks in here and wants to look different, very different."
Her expression was so solemn that I believed her.
"Dreamed it just last night," she said.
"I told you to surprise me, and you just did."
"In the dream, I knew the guy was in trouble. He had enemies."
"I don't know what to say."
"Probably you shouldn't say anything. If you did, maybe your trouble would become mine."
I nodded, took out my wallet, and paid her. As I turned to leave the tent, she said,
"Don't worry. Your own mother wouldn't know you."
I said, "She never has." 18. Painted to deceive, I set out in search of what I did not know. The vast majority of those attending the carnival didn't sport a mask from Face It. However, there were enough of us that no one seemed to be especially interested in me. I walked the fairground midway, where the whip lashed its riders this way and that, where the caterpillar enveloped screaming patrons in darkness as it slung them around a track 1,000 times faster than any real caterpillar could move, where the big drop lifted its gondola 200 feet into the night and then released it in what seemed to be an uncontrolled free fall, and where the Ferris wheel carried its passengers high and brought them low, and raised them high and brought them low again, as if it were not merely a carnival ride, but also a metaphor for the basic pattern of human experience. It's difficult to spend time in any carnival or amusement park and not realize that a repressed fear of death may be the one emotion that is constant in the human heart, even if, most of the time, it is confined to the unconscious as we go about our business. Thrill rides offer us a chance to acknowledge our ever-present dread, to release the tension that arises from repression of it, and to subtly delude ourselves with the illusion of invulnerability that surviving the big drop can provide. The carnival blazed. Every ride and many other attractions decorated with low-watt bulbs, neon tubes, blinkers, and twinklers. Strings of colored lights overhung the U-shaped concourse. At the curve of the U, mounted on a flatbed truck and reliant on a chugging gasoline-powered generator, 2 massive swiveling spotlights threw their beams into the heavens, revealing the bellies of an armada of clouds, like dirigibles, invading silently from the southwest. In spite of all the colorful lighting that had been crafted to attract patrons and to put them in a celebratory mood, the carnival had an air of hostility and menace that, I felt sure, was not merely my perception. Within all the dazzle and glitter and bright fake glamour, a hidden presence lurked, a watchful darkness that observed and hated and waited, a presence that I had not sensed 6 years earlier. Although the warm air was richly scented with the aromas of buttered popcorn, candy apples, cotton candy, the cinnamon and sugar and fried dough of churros, nevertheless, as I threaded through the colorful tapestry of people on the concourse, there were times when a delicious aroma suddenly soured. For just a moment, cinnamon had a sulfurous edge, and the popcorn butter smelled rancid, as if under all its pretense of good healthy fun, the carnival was a dangerous swamp in which moldered and festered things too horrific to contemplate. The funhouse featured the giant face of an ogre, 20 feet from chin to crown, nearly that wide, a dimensional sculpture of such imaginative detail that it managed to be scary at the same time that it was pure hokum. Periodically, a roar issued from its open mouth, and with the roar came a forceful blast of air that traveled about 20 feet into the promenade, surprising people who encountered it for the first time, mussing their hair and startling them so that popcorn was dropped halfway from box to mouth. The ogre's crazed eyes rolled in their sockets, but I knew that I was being paranoid to think that it was watching me in particular. The ballyhoo of pitchmen, the clatter and whoosh of the rides, the interlaced melodies of scores of different songs associated with various attractions, and the chatter and laughter of a few thousand voices appeared to inspire bright-eyed delight among many of the patrons. To me, it sounded like a shrill, discordant symphony, to which I might expect to see a horde of bodocks quivering and capering in an ecstasy of anticipated chaos, though I had not glimpsed even one of them among this multitude. Within 10 minutes, I came to a large tent where flamboyant lettering emblazoned on the canvas above the entrance promised, "All things foretold." In smaller script under those words appeared the, come on, 33 opportunities to